every Sunday. Elise Glenk is live and new to guide you through your money and real estate questions only on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glenk Show. It is our last show before Christmas. So glad you could join us today. Online all the time, my website, thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. I want to alert you that coming up on the 27th and 28th, Challenger Grand Christmas is going to suspend their normal business operations for 2 days. They're the long-term unemployment global outplacement firm. They're going to do their 26th annual two-day national job search call-in. It's absolutely free, so if you're looking for a job 27th and 28th and you've got questions, these guys are the place to call, and I'll give you that number a little bit later on in the show, or you can go to their website at challengergray.com. 404-872-0750 is our number. But we have a great show for you today. We are going to talk about taxes, and we are going to talk about MF Global and things going on in the economy. And then next hour, we're going to do a whole hour on finding a job in the new year, and that's where the Challenger Grand Christmas stuff ties in. So it's going to be a great 2 hours. Get comfortable, get another cup of coffee, and we're going to dive right in. Eva Rosenberg is on the line with us. Eva is an enrolled agent. Her website, which is amazing, is taxmama.com. But I met Eva, I met her a long time ago, but I really got to know her when we started to use her to help write the tax information on the Equifax Finance blog, where she's been blogging now for almost 2 years. Eva, welcome back to the show. Great to have you.
Well, thank you so very much. It's wonderful to actually speak to you in person again.
No,
email.
I know. We're so technology-oriented, aren't we? We tweet. We do all these things. Are you at TaxMama on Twitter?
Yes, I am. Branding is important when we're talking about businesses.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about small businesses because, you know, here we are, the end of another year. It's not been a particularly good year. I mean, the big corporations seem to be making money, but there are whole kinds of small businesses that aren't making that much money, or they're actually losing money. And I know that you have a large part of your practice in California with small businesses, and you sent over some statistics that I thought were pretty interesting. Non-farm small businesses in 2009, the net profits were $245 billion. There were 22.6 million returns, and they had gross income of nearly $1.2 trillion. But of those, 6 million non-farm businesses didn't have any profits. 27% had losses. That's not a good thing for the IRS if you're losing money year after year, and yet so many businesses have done just that with this great recession, which just, I know for Main Street, just doesn't seem to be ending. So talk a little bit about some of your clients who have had these losses and how they need to plan now that they're getting to near the end of the year.
Well, you know, that's a shocking number, and that's from 2009. So, you know, imagine what it is in 2010 and 11. Most of my clients, believe it or not, are not losing money. I have vision, and one of the things that I really try to encourage my clients to do is to plan ahead and anticipate changes in the economy. You know, I had one client who was selling fabrics, you know, in the schmata business. You know, that's just what we call it down here, right? And I told him several years ago, you are going to be out of business unless you're dealing with China. So either go find something else to do or start dealing with China. Your prices are going to be undercut. He did, and he started doing great. He went to China.
So you're able to look out for some of your clients and say, let's anticipate with what you do how you might be able to navigate. But that's not always possible. Like, what would you do in terms of real estate business? So Georgia, like Southern California, it's abysmal what's going on with foreclosures and short sales. And so there are agents who just, you know, seriously, the agents, the title companies, the appraisers, some inspectors, the home builders, I mean, this is just a really troubled sector.
It's terrible. But, you know, Are agents in Georgia able to do things like they can in California? Here in California, licensed real estate agents can also sell loans. And this is one of the best times in my entire life, probably in history, to be able to get a loan. Loan rates are so incredibly low. And usually when loan rates are low, prices are high. I can't remember any time ever when prices were low and loan rates were low. So, you know, I switch my people over and say, look, it's time to start looking at loans and hit up your clients who have money sitting aside that they don't want in the market because the market is so unpredictable. This is the time to buy some solid, low-cost properties. And if you screen your tenants really well, you can get reliable tenants.
So when you're helping your clients with this kind of, I would call this business planning, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
So tell me a little bit about the process. Like, what are some steps that you can help our listeners think about in terms of their own businesses or even their own financial lives? Like, what are these steps that they should look out and what are they looking for exactly to help guide them?
Well, first of all, the first thing you have to do is you really have to know what's going on in your industry. If you're living in a bubble, forget it. You know, you really need to be paying attention to the trade organizations in your industry, to the online organizations, talk to the groups. You need to see what the chatter is, the gossip and everything else that's going on. Twitter feeds in your industry are very important. You find out some of the changes. You need to read the appropriate publications. You know, and you're involved in several of those publications. And if they're reading this stuff in the Wall Street Journal and Market Watch and so forth, you need to find out what's happening in the world. You need to get familiar with your industry and talk to your clients. What do your clients need? You know, I was talking to one company, not a client, you know, when I was interviewing them, and you know, they were involved in some industry that they'd been doing for years and years and years, and he started asking his clients what else they could use because sales were starting to drop off, and they told him other services that they could use. And so he started adding some of those other services little by little, and it works. Find out from your clients what else you can do for them.
You know, that's
and what
actually,
they don't need.
Well, that's such a great and no-brainer kind of thing to do. And I've done it myself recently with one of our clients. I said, you know, we have some extra capacity, and I know you guys are looking. What else can we help you do? And they said, well, we were thinking about, you know, doing an e-book. And I said, well, we do a lot of those e-books. And they said, yeah, we know, but could you also do... And then because we were talking, it was like, well, okay, you could do that. Could you also do this?
Exactly.
And could you build a microsite for us? And I said, sure, we could build a microsite for you. And suddenly, because we have. And so suddenly there was a business opportunity that we hadn't anticipated that will really help for the first quarter of next year.
Yeah, so you're starting to look at different niches that are available. And, you know, if you're talking to your clients, especially people who are starting to spend less money with you, or your customers who are spending less money with you, what else can you do for them? Maybe they're spending less money because they don't need your services, but maybe because they can't afford them as much anymore. Is there some other way you can help them and keep them as a customer? You know, during the bad years, one of the things that I did was my clients who couldn't afford my fees, I insisted on doing their tax returns anyway because they need to be done. Otherwise, they wouldn't do them.
Right, and that just causes so many more problems down the line.
Yeah.
And as you point out, when you have losses year after year and you are looking to, you know, pinch pennies, that's the time when the IRS can actually, you know, swoops in to audit you because, what is it, 3 years and it kind of triggers a red flag or 5 years in a row it triggers a red flag?
Right. You need to be making a profit 3 years out of five, or if you're farming or ranching, you know, you can't have losses more than two years out of seven. So, you know, IRS is starting to look at that. Obviously, they know right now the economy is worse, but a lot of businesses have always been showing losses. And the reason that IRS looks at that is there are two big reasons. One, either if you're continuing this business year after year, right, and you don't have any other business or mm-hmm. any other jobs, either you're not reporting all your income.
Right.
Or this is a hobby and you have other income somewhere else.
Right.
You know, and so if it's a hobby, you don't get the losses. And if you're not reporting the income, IRS wants your money.
Yeah, they're funny about that.
They are.
They just want it. I don't know. They want it, and then they want some penalties if they feel like you really haven't been paying. The other thing that I've heard, that, and I know that businesses have been cheating on this a little bit, you know, there's this whole issue now with hiring contractors instead of employees, so 1099s instead of W-2s, because you're saving on the unemployment. Which is very expensive. My unemployment rate in the state of Illinois has gone up to something like 7.3%. It's just it's just crazy.
Why?
We let somebody go a couple of years ago.
Oh, okay.
And so one person after, 10 years of doing it, and so our rate shot up. But everybody's rate got increased because, as you may have heard, next to California, Illinois is the brokest state.
our rates got increased as well. I asked my office manager why our rate went up, because we haven't let anyone go. And she said it went up for everybody.
Yeah. And so we had that in the state of Illinois. And then on top of that, we, unfortunately, a couple of years ago, had to let somebody go. So to go back to it, companies are trying to get out of paying the taxes and the other stuff by hiring contractors, and yet my understanding is that the IRS is cracking down on that as well, and they've hired new agents specifically to look for companies that are kind of cheating in that way. Is that what you're seeing?
Oh, God, and it's free money for IRS. They know they're going to get the money. Plus, they instituted a new form about 2 or 3 years ago, a form 8919. And so when you're sending out 1099s to people who worked for you who should have been employees, and those people don't want to be paying your share of their taxes, and they're going to use this form 8919 to pick up only their half of the taxes, file this other form, this SS8 that does an employee evaluation, am I really an employee or am I really an independent contractor, which is going to trigger an audit, that points right at your business. You're probably going to get mad and fire that employee, which will generate a labor lawsuit.
Oh, yeah, it's bad all the way around.
Yeah,
it keeps getting worse.
Don't do that. However, IRS announced earlier this year, and I think in the October Market Watch column I was writing about this, they have a new amnesty program for employers who have been messing up in this area.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and a lot of accountants are kind of iffy on whether they want to encourage their clients to participate in this program or not, and there's no deadline. This is an open-ended amnesty. So employers who want to get back into the payroll system and don't want to get caught, because they know they're about to get caught anyway, it's probably a good idea. If they fill out the program, the forms for the amnesty, they're only going to have to pay taxes for about a tenth of the taxes for 1 year's worth of payroll that they would have owed. Theoretically, no audit on the back years, and they can come back in out of the cold and just go clean next year.
Wow, that actually seems like a decent amnesty program.
It actually does. I was trying to find the pitfalls. The main pitfall I see is the state. You've been doing this and avoiding state taxes. What is the state going to do? You're not going to file paperwork with the state. You're just going to, start hiring employees. Is the state going to look back at the last 3 years?
Yeah, state and federal, it's always a little bit of a different story. We're on with Eva Rosenberg. She's an enrolled agent. Her website is taxmama.com. On Twitter, she's at taxmama. She blogs for us at the Equifax Finance blog, which you can find at equifax.com. Just click on Finance blog. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, a few last-minute tips for business owners before the end of the year, things you might want to do to make next year's tax return, March 15th, a little bit easier. I'm Elise Glink. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more on News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on. Weekdays with Clark Howard and Dave Ramsey. And midday every Sunday with Elise Glink on AM 750. And now, 95.5 FM. News Talk WSB.
Show. We're counting it down. It's 1 week to Christmas. I can hardly believe it. I'm on with Eva Rosenberg. She's an enrolled agent, tax genius. Her website, taxmama.com, and she blogs for us at the Equifax Finance blog. So, Eva, if you so many small business clients, give us one or two quick tips, things that small business owners ought to think about before the end of the year that's going to make next March 15th a little bit easier.
Okay, two quick things. One, start looking at a Section 105 medical plan, medical and insurance plan for your small business. If you don't have any employees, you just have the family, you can have family coverage to take care of the whole thing, and it won't cost very much. You'll make a whole lot more in tax savings if you do that. And the other thing, if you have children, you can have an employer child care facility credit that will pay you back thousands of dollars, and hardly anybody knows you can do this. It's in Chapter 10 of Small Business Taxes Made Easy.
Wow. And that is your book.
And that is my book.
Available at Amazon and also at your website?
Absolutely.
Sounds good. Eva Rosenberg, a tax genius, but we'll just call her an enrolled agent. TaxMama.com. Follow her at the Equifax Finance blog. Thanks for being with us. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Hanukkah, and all the rest.
And have a less taxing year.
I hope so. I'm Elise Kling. Stay tuned. We have John Watson coming up next. We're going to talk to him about what's going on with MF Global and some of the other big news stories, business news stories of the year. I'm Elise Kling. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinklink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Kling Show. It's a week until Christmas. I can hardly believe it. I'm so glad you could join us today. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, online all the time. Thinklink.com, thinkglink.com. So we have my good friend John Wasik with us this hour. John is a writer. He was syndicated for a long time, but he's been online as a columnist and blogger for a long time. He does contribute also to the Equifax Finance blog. He's also the author of a book called The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, which was published a year or so ago by John Wiley, which is amazing. John's actually written more books than I have, and all of them are better than my books, so you want to check him out at Amazon. It's true.
No, it's not.
Your books are so thoughtful and really thought-provoking, which is so great. His website is John, J-O-H-N, Wasik, W-A-S-I-K.com, and you can follow his musings at John Wasik on Twitter. John, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Yes, nice to have you. So, okay, so news of the week, we saw that mortgage interest rates this week went back down to that record low. They're like below 4% for a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. If you have the best credit score and you have plenty of equity in your house and you've got some cash for whatever to pay closing costs, you could actually get one of these loans.
Well, you have to have a real good credit rating, and you can't be underwater, and you can't be doing fancy things like buying condos or investment properties. You won't get that rock-bottom rate unless your credit record is absolutely pristine. You have steady income, and everything else looks good on paper. That's the catch.
Yeah, it's kind of a big catch, because I think that by now, I mean, I don't know about you, but we've just refinanced. We got a 15-year, I don't know, maybe 6 months ago for about 3.25%, which was sort of silly. Although in an investment property we have, I think it's an adjustable rate mortgage, and it just went down again to like under 3%. But a lot of people are having trouble refinancing.
Well, you know, you have to have a FICO, which is your credit score, at least above 720. A lot of people are getting hurt. You know, if their job is iffy, or if they've been unemployed, it's going to be very bad for your credit record. If you've had, you know, a lot of debts outstanding, it's not going to look good. And, of course, if you're underwater, that's a big sort of scar on your credit record. Or it's not your credit record, but, you know, your ability to get the money.
Oh, it's absolutely true. Now, it's interesting. In my column a couple of weeks ago, my syndicated column, I was talking about how, and this is advice I've been giving for a long time, and I want to get your feedback on it. I've been telling people, you know, before you go and talk to the lender and have them pull your credit score, you should go to annualcreditreport.com and get your credit history, and then pay the $9 and get a copy of the credit score. And I like to use the Equifax one because it most closely models the one that's used by the lenders, right? I mean, it's like matches up with the FICO score. But I had a lender take me on this week, and we've put it into the column, and he's like, that's terrible advice because the lenders, mortgage lenders, actually use a special score from, they use a score from, like, from FICO that's a housing-related score. They call it, like, the home FICO score, let's call it, right? And that he says that that score is reliably 60 to 80 points below the annual credit report score. Now, I had heard that that score might actually be higher than the annual credit report score. And he's like, you're telling people to go do that, and then they bring it in, they can't qualify for anything. What do you think?
Well, it never hurts to take a look at your credit report. You always have to see if there's inaccurate information. There's certain ways of raising your credit score. There might be loans out there that you paid off. I mean, you really need to clear it up. You really need to see where you're at, because there are some really concrete ways of bringing that score up. So there's really no instance in which, at least looking at it and trying to see if it can be improved is bad advice. So,
and I think it gives you a range, right? I mean, if you pull a copy of your Equifax, TransUnion, whatever score you pull, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you pull the copy of that score and the score says you're at 640, you're probably not going to do very well. If you go to get a mortgage, you're certainly not going to get a 30-year loan at under 4%. But if it says you're in the upper 700s, right, you probably have a good shot at it.
Oh, yeah, you're in the ballpark. Then, of course, they look at, you know, how much equity have you in your home. They look at your employment record. They look at, you know, if you have any money in the bank. I mean, there's a lot of other factors, and it's not just the credit report.
Right. And there's actually things that trip you up all the time. So I heard from somebody a couple of, I don't know, maybe it was a month ago or so on the show, and they said, well, we actually look amazing. We have credit scores in the 800s. We've got plenty of money in the bank. We have plenty of equity, but he's like a minority owner in a business that had a $1,500 loss. The guy makes six figures, but they X'd him out for a mortgage because he had this $1,500 loss from a business in which he's like, you know, a 10% owner. And they're like, well, we don't know. Next year your loss could be $15,000. He's like, it still wouldn't matter. Well, it could be $150,000. We don't know. You can't get a loan.
Yeah, unfortunately, the way the market is right now, you're looking at absolutely pristine records. So it's very, very hard to get that 3.9% 30-year loan. It looks great, but, you know, it's only for people who are virtually perfect.
Right, and really, you know, I'm not, of course you and I are, right? But, no, you know, it's really hard for that. The other problem that I'm seeing go out there, and this is something that I'm working on with a company called eCredible, which is a company that looks at alternative credit, right? And we've seen a couple of companies start to announce that they're going to help automate your rent payments, your utility payments. They're going to aggregate, if you send money regularly out of the country with Western Union, they're going to, you know, your auto insurance payments. A lot of people who don't have any credit or have what's known as a thin credit file, it's like 50, 60 million Americans, they have no way to prove that they are credit worthy. So if they have to go buy a car, for example, they end up with those buy-here, pay-here places where you get awful, perfectly awful cars at really high prices with 30% interest rates. And there's this whole move now that the federal government is requiring lenders to consider alternative credit, right, that for these different kinds of companies. I happen to work with eCredible, but there's others out there, to try and automate this and bring in those 50 or 60 million Americans who don't even have the kind of credit to be able to get a under 4% mortgage.
Well, Lise, although you and I have been saying this for years, that you have to have a good credit rating, there's a lot of counterintuitive stuff in the FICO rating. For example, if you haven't had credit, you know, if you're just paying cash for everything, you'll have a low credit rating because in order to get credit, you have to establish credit. So, like, say you're just out of school, you know, you're just out of college, you know, you're not going to have any ability to get credit. So FICO is, you have to look at what they're looking at. Sometimes, you know, having very low balances is not good. Sometimes, you know, high balances isn't so bad relative to your income. If you go to myfico.com, you can kind of look at their categories. And the catch is that the whole FICO calculation is a big secret. So you never really know quite what they're looking at and how they weigh these things. So
although they tell you what's in a FICO score, you know, 35% is how you pay your bills, and 30%
right,
is the amount that you owe, and 15% is the length of the credit history, and 10% is new credit, and 10% is types of credit use. But there's a lot of fudge factor in that sauce, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of nuance, so it can get very tricky. But, you know, if your debts are very low and you pay on time for all your credit lines and credit cards, and you have good equity in your home, you should be able to get a decent rate.
I would think that you could, that you should be able to. I just don't know for a lot of Americans if that's actually a possibility. And I get the sense that, you know, the three or four credit reporting bureaus or credit reporting agencies, CRAs that they're officially called, are kind of fighting with each other about trying to grab the piece of what seems to be an ever-shrinking pie. I mean, think about all the numbers of Americans who are now delinquent in their loans, 25%, right? And then you've got... how many, 4 or 5 million Americans have gone into foreclosure since this Great Recession started? There's probably another 3 or 4 million still to go into foreclosure. We know that lenders are going to step that up. It seems like there's an ever-expanding pie of people with poor credit history in this country.
Oh, yeah, and it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. And what happened since 2008, the two major mortgage insurers, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, decided to go very conservative. And these are the agencies, even though they're still owned and kind of, you know, seized by the government, they're making the rules for the lender. So let's say you have a 620 FICO score, not too terrible. You can still get a loan, but the lender, as per Freddie and Fannie guidelines, will tack on 3 percentage points to that loan. So, you know, even though you may be able to get it, it's going to cost you a fortune.
Right.
So these are their standards, and this is what they are telling lenders. If you're buying an investment property, you pay 0.75 points extra.
And you have to have 35% down or 40% down.
Right, and you have to have lots of equity, adjustable loans, there's premiums for that, cash out refis, premiums for that. I mean, this is all Freddie and Fannie, and these are the agencies that got into trouble, are really technically... fiscally still in the deep hole.
Huge. And they'll never be able to buy their way out.
No, and the government has to figure out, well, what do we do with these guys? I mean, do we privatize them? Do we,
all right, well, so,
you know,
let me ask you a question about that, because last January of 2010, the government was required by law to come up with a plan for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of a plan?
No, they're sitting on it. It's not going to happen this year, and
you mean this year, meaning 2012 or 2011?
2011, nothing will happen.
Yeah, it's over.
Next year, very unlikely. They'll do a trial balloon maybe in the first quarter if we get one at all, you know, saying this is what we're thinking of doing. And because it's so critical, because basically the mortgage market has been nationalized.
Yeah.
Because the government's buying most of the, 80%, 90% of the loans?
No, 93%.
Now?
Hello?
Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, there is no private mortgage market to speak of.
No, and can you answer a question for me, which is, and I've asked this question, nobody's ever called in to give me the answer. Why are Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac still publicly traded companies? Why can you buy shares on the market?
Well, because technically they haven't shut them down.
I know.
They never went into Chapter 11 the way a public company would. They were seized by the Treasury, so they're wards of the state. And the White House and you know, the Treasury Department have not figured out what they can do with them. So if you shut them down, then it wipes out most of this, you know, capacity to buy private loans. You don't want that, because they'll totally kill the housing market. If you kind of reprivatize them, you have to find the capital to do that. They have a tremendous amount of bad debt, which is mostly owned by the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. What do you do with that? I mean, it's one of these things, there's no easy way to deal with it. And then any plan they do will have to be oriented towards, you know, giving a real buoy to the mortgage market. And that was originally what they were supposed to do, and they got into trouble.
We are on the phone with John Wasik, my good friend, writer, columnist, author of Cul-de-Sac Syndrome. The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, you can find it online at Amazon, along with his 12 other amazing books. You can find John at johnwasik.com or at John Wasik, W-A-S-I-K, at Twitter. I'm Elise Glink. We'll be right back with John in just a moment on News Talk WSB.
Elise Glink is live and new to guide you through your money and real estate questions only on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody. It is the countdown. down to Christmas. 7 days, we're on with John Wasik, my good friend, writer, columnist, author of The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome. You can find it online at Amazon or at his website, johnwasik.com. So, John, what are you telling people? Year-end stuff, we've got 2 weeks to go to the end of the year, really less if you want to get something done on business days. What should people be thinking about? Got a couple quick tips?
Sure. The most important thing is, you know, there's been a lot of turmoil in the market. You know, we're still looking at Europe, see if the other shoe is going to drop. I think it's going to be okay. And there's this mild sort of kind of rebound going on, and you should really keep an eye on that. And don't forget to invest. So if you're going to make an investment, how do you do it? Well, I'm not going to give you individual stocks, but you should be doing an investment policy statement. That's basically saying, you know, look, this is where I'm at, this is how old I am, this is what I want to do. These are your personal goals. Forget about the markets. Find out where you should be. Should you be investing in stocks? Should you be ramping up your bond position?
So it's like a risk assessment, basically. What's going to let you sleep at night?
Only you write it down.
Yeah.
And most people intuitively know what really makes their stomach turn about this stuff.
And everything these days? Everything?
Yeah. Everything, and you should be able to say, look, I'm going to write down my goals, and this is going to be my plan for the next year, for the next 10 years. You can revise it whenever you want. You know, say you want 40% in stocks. If you can live with that, that's what you should be doing, and forget about the headlines. You'll be okay. So these are long-term goals, and then again, you have to know where you want to put your money. You know, do you want to buy an annuity? Do you want to buy high dividend stocks? To me, you know, there's a lot of profitable companies out there, and there's a lot of decent mutual funds that invest in these companies and go with safety. Go with the ones that are consistently paying dividends and make sure that they're part of your portfolio.
Right, and you can search, I think, on Morningstar by dividends, and if not there, what's another good resource for people?
Morningstar is usually the best. Look for high dividend funds. Fidelity has one. Vanguard has one.
They all have them.
You can get them in exchange-traded funds, iShares. You know, that's a good kind of core holding. And make sure you're very diversified. Don't just invest in U.S. stocks. Make sure that you're in emerging markets. It wouldn't hurt to be in Europe just a little bit because it will come back once they solve this stuff. And make sure you're invested all over the world.
It's such a flat world, for sure. John Wasik is the author of The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, my very good friend, blogger, and columnist. Have a Merry Christmas.
Happy Hanukkah.
Thank you very much. Find John at John Wasik, J-O-H-N-W-A-S-I-K, at Twitter, or johnwasik.com. And we have coming up a whole hour on how to find a job in the new year. Some amazing resources and tips for you. You're going to want to stay tuned for that. I'm Elise Klink. You're listening to AM 750 and now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
Cash, cold, that's what I need.
Advice you can depend on. Weekdays with Clark Howard and Dave Ramsey, and midday every Sunday with Elise Glink on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, live on Sundays 11 to 1 here on News Talk WSB. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, online all the time, thinkglink.com. Now, I promised you we're going to spend this hour talking about how to get a job in the new year, and we are, but there's some breaking news that Bill Nemeth, who's president of the Georgia Association of Enrolled Agents, has sent along. He is telling me that the IRS is having substantial problems processing tax returns in which you repay part of the first-time homebuyer tax credit, right? So he is saying there is a long processing time, multiple months, if you paid back the $500 you owed on your 2010 return from your 2008 first-time homebuyer credit loan. So the IRS has created a web-based first-time home buyer credit lookup tool that allows taxpayers to look up their personal information about this credit. The lookup tool will not be available until January 17th of 2012, and this is probably the date that the IRS is going to open up for business, which is sort of interesting. But in the lookup tool, you're going to need to self-authenticate by providing your Social Security number, your date of birth, your complete address. It's the same process as when you go in and look for where's my refund. And then the lookup tool should display your last four digits of your Social Security number, the original amount of the credit claimed, your required annual repayment amount, and the amount of the credit already repaid, and the total balance that's left. So the lookup tool is going to be very useful, but if you have been waiting for your return and your refund, this is why it's taking a long, long time. So I'll try and put this up on the website for you, but we'll talk about it again in advance of January 17th, just so that everybody who needs this information can get it. And you can probably get it online from the Georgia Association of Enrolled Agents, the number 4GAEA.org. Now, let's turn to the unemployment situation. The numbers this week were the best looking in nearly 3.5 years. The unemployment claims, first-time home unemployment claims, are down to the lowest level in 3.5 years. It is a sign, some experts are saying, that the waves of corporate layoffs that have defined the last few years are all but over, which is great news if that's really true. I don't know if it is. Morgan Stanley this week announced it was laying off 1,600 people. So those are high-paying jobs. I'm not sure it's completely over. But we are adding about 100,000 jobs or more every month. That's good. Not nearly enough, but it's good. But the number of people applying for unemployment benefits came in at 366,000, down from 385,000 the week before. We are moving closer to the pre-recession range of roughly 280,000 to 350,000, and I would really like to see it at that 250,000 level. So at that time, believe it or not, we had a 5.4% unemployment rate. We have been above 8% unemployment for almost 3 years. And if you are looking for a job, you're going to want to check out Challenger Grain Christmas. So every year for 26 years, this is the international global outplacement firm. What they do every year for 2 days is they suspend normal business operations, and their staff of professional counselors will provide free job search advice to callers from across the country. This year it's December 27th and 28th. I'll be filling in for Clark on the 28th, 29th, and 30th, so I'll be there for the second day. 9 to 5 Central Standard Time. Call in. It's completely free, and you get amazing advice. 312-422-5010. Now, for those of you who don't want to wait, fortunately for you, we have on the phone our good friend, Liz Handlin. She's the president of ultimate-resumes.com. She spends her career helping people try and reformulate themselves and basically reboot their job search. And I'm so glad you've come on. Liz, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Elise.
So fun to have you. So, you know, what are people doing? You know, it looks like the job market might be starting to move a little bit. You know, what are some of the best things that people can do? What should they avoid doing?
There's a couple of great things you can do. And generally what I tell people is go old school with your job search. So what that means is use the internet for research. CareerBuilder, Monster.com are great tools for research, but don't limit yourself to applying for jobs just online, because your resume may not get seen, and it's really more effective to seek out companies that you'd like to work for, focus on meeting decision makers at those companies, and, you know, sending your resume judiciously to companies that appeal to you.
Okay. So when you are starting to look for that kind of stuff, I mean, I know people are submitting thousands of resumes to companies and they're not getting anything back. I know you believe in a very personalized resume, almost an individually tailored resume for each different kind of position. How should people strategically think about that?
What you want to think about is what is your value proposition that you bring to each, to any employer. Most of us have a skill set, a set of tools that we would use anywhere we worked, right? So you could be terrific at marketing, and in almost every job that you do, whether or not that's a marketing job or not, that skill set comes to the, bubbles up to the surface. So what you want to get across on your career, on your resume, is your value proposition, that unique set of skills that only you have and that you would bring to any job. It can be a little bit tricky to do. It's sometimes helpful to have a sounding board, but that's how you're going to find really a job that's best for you.
And I know you're a big believer in this networking idea. What are some different kinds of ways that people can network? Because I think if you've been out of, and this is a real problem for people who've been out of the job market for 2 and 3 years, right? Their contacts change. Maybe they don't connect in the same way. There is LinkedIn that they can use to start to reconnect with past people from their companies and reconnect that way. But, you know, what should people be doing to maintain those connections and try to, you know, build this personal network? How do you do that?
Well, ideally, you never lose touch with your network, right? But that's not realistic. So this is the holiday season. There's never a bad time to reach out to people, write a personalized note, send a holiday card, and just reach out and reconnect without asking for anything. I think the mistake that sometimes people make, and this has happened to me frequently, someone that I haven't heard from in 15 years suddenly calls me because they want something. They need a job. They have a problem. No one really likes to be put in that position. So if you want to reconnect with your network, do something nice for them. Send a card. Contact them and say, hey, I know, I remember it's your daughter's birthday. Some way of reaching out and reconnecting where there's nothing expected in return, and then use that as the entree to rebuild a relationship so that it's appropriate to ask for help or a favor.
I think that's actually really amazing advice. So, you know, here we are, the holiday season, and I remember that I used to send out, like, you know, maybe 1,000 or 600 cards. I no longer send that many, but if there was somebody I wanted to get in touch with, that is such a great idea. Even with, I find that small gifts, like if you're thinking somebody that you were in touch with or was a boss and you remembered, let's say they liked salted caramels, for example, I could see sending like a tiny little box with just a note thinking about you and this holiday, ran across this and thought you'd like it.
That is a wonderful idea. I had a friend the other day who sent me a card, and in it was a photo of one of Elizabeth Taylor's diamonds, which has gone on auction, and all he said was, I know that you would have loved it if I could afford to get this for you, or something like that. So what did I do? I called him, because it was so funny, and it was so cute, and that's exactly, sending an inexpensive gift, a gift card, a gift certificate, or even donating a nominal amount to a charity that might be near and dear to this person's heart. Let's say that you know that one of their family members has gotten cancer, but you haven't been in touch in years. Make a donation to the American Cancer Society in their name, $10 or $15, something very nominal, and they will actually send a letter from you to the family and let them know. So there's a million different things that you can do that cost little or nothing to let people know, I'm thinking of you, I'd like to reconnect, but not doing it in a way that you have your hand out.
How many connections do you need with somebody before you ask for help? Like, is there a number? Could it be, is it one? Is it three? Is it 6 months? Is it a month? Like, how do you quantify that, or can you even quantify it?
I don't think you can quantify it. I think you have to be sensitive to the other person. Generally, I would say 3 or 4 contacts, but with some people who are very, very sensitive about being taken advantage of, we all know someone like that, then maybe it takes a little bit more time.
Right.
But the focus is on having a real and meaningful connection with someone. And a lot of people get very lazy. We all do at times. And you think, oh, I have so much to do. I don't have time to, you know, send a birthday card to that person. And then they drop off your radar. So, you know, it's really about reconnecting on a personal level and making people feel good. It could be a postcard, something funny. Sometimes you'll see these funny postcards in the store when you're waiting in line. Sending somebody one of those, saying, hey, I thought you would think this was really funny. Costs you almost nothing, but it helps you to reconnect in an appropriate way.
Is a tool like LinkedIn very helpful for this kind of stuff? Because I think it feels to me like I'm LinkedIn to about 1,000 people, or maybe 2,000, I don't know. It just seems like everybody's LinkedIn, but is that not true?
And what I think LinkedIn can be very useful if you're smart about how you use it. If you have 2,000 people that you're connected to on LinkedIn, I would advise you that that's too many. Unless you actually know all those people. I only connect with people on LinkedIn whom I actually know, clients, friends, former classmates. What I love about LinkedIn is that about once a week, if you have your settings set right, they'll send you a LinkedIn update, and it updates you to changes with your contact. So if somebody gets a new job, if they change their profile, I always read that. And when I notice that somebody that I know has found a new job, I immediately send them a quick email and say, hey, congratulations on the new job. So that's how it can be really useful. I don't think it's a good way to meet perfect strangers by sending them, you know, just emails, but it can be a great way to find out the names of decision makers who work for certain companies, then contact them at their office and say, may I buy you a cup of coffee and find out more about your career.
Right.
I'm a big fan of the personal connection.
Yeah, I think personal connections are really important, and I think about LinkedIn and sort of using it in a way that is very smart. And I find for job hunters, like when I was looking, we've looked to fill a bunch of positions this year, and the positions we were filling were journalism jobs. So Media Bistro is a really amazing resource that all the journalists read. And so we placed an ad there. And then we also placed an ad in, because we were looking for some specific kinds of qualifications, we placed an ad at LinkedIn. And I ended up with, the first time I placed an ad, I ended up with like 1,500 page views of the job description.
Wow.
Of which like maybe 150 people applied for the job. The second time we got, but over on Media Bistro, we had twice as many. Like it was more, several thousand people looked at it. But we only got maybe 50 to 75 resumes from that one. But it's interesting that you're looking in different areas, and if there is a place like a Media Bistro for journalists, which is kind of a listserv plus of jobs, plus it gives you the latest journalism news every day, right? Media news. If there's something like that in your particular industry, it seems like you should be on it and following it, because these kinds of information aggregators, for lack of a better term, seem to be a place where people who are employers looking for to hire people are looking.
That's correct.
I didn't go to Career Builder. I mean, I hate to say.
Well, the reason that you probably didn't is because Career Builder and Monster and other job sites like them are basically like a giant pot, and everybody's thrown in that pot. And what you want is your market segmented. So Media Bistro segments it for you. I'm not going to get on Media Bistro if I'm not a journalist to begin with.
Right.
And the challenge with some of these larger aggregators is if you put your resume on there from a hiring manager's perspective, if I happen to have one word on my resume, I could be in a completely different industry, but if one word on my resume matches whatever search criteria, you know, I may get a million resumes.
Right.
So it makes it very challenging for employers to find your resume. And I tell people sometimes, if you send your resume via one of these large aggregators, your resume may never get seen. It's better to focus on the niche job sites. But I'm always a fan of find out where the job is if you can, find out what company, research it, and contact them through one of your network contacts, or mail them a resume or email them or whatever, but don't do it through this aggregator.
We're talking with Liz Hanlon. She is ultimate-resumes.com, an amazing font of advice. She's got all kinds of blogs that she does. You should check her out at her website, ultimateresumes.com. I'm Elise Glink. We'll be right back with more next on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at ThinkLink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show on AM 750, now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB. We were talking with Liz Hanlon of ultimate-resumes.com. It's an amazing thing to understand how you can make those personal connections. She's such a huge fan of this idea of person-to-person networking your way into a job. And, in fact, this is, as a job creator, which I seem to be this year since I've been hiring a bunch of people for different projects, it's exactly the way that we think, right? So when I'm thinking about hiring somebody, I'm out there, and the first thing I do is go to people who do something similar to what I'm looking for. And I say to them, who do you know? And then they say, oh, well, I know these people, and did you try this website and this listserv, and I could connect you with this person. It's while we did go to LinkedIn and we did go to Media Bistro, we also did a lot of person-to-person stuff, and we have found really great people that way. And in some ways, it's an even better way to find somebody, because you get the personal recommendation. You get somebody who's worked with that person before. So if you are looking for a job, your number one task this year has got to be to network your way back into the land of the employed. And so our next guest coming up is from Career Builder, the website, a big monster website as it happens, for job seekers. And we're going to talk a little bit about how to find that crucial job linkage. So whether it's personal networking or online, how to make the most of it and get the job of your dreams this year in 2012. So stay tuned for that. We'll have some other news and information as well. I'm Elise Glink. You're listening to AM 750 and now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
Sunday, Elise Glink is live and new to guide you through your money and real estate questions only on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show live on Sundays 11 to 1 here on News Talk WSB. Last week before Christmas, I hope you got your Christmas shopping up and out. I will be taking Christmas off. I'm hoping you're getting to do the same, although we're going to have some other great programming here on WSB all day. But I will be back in time and filling in for Clark for the end of the year as we do our final March up. So the 28th, 29th, 30th, mark your calendars, 1 o'clock, we kick it off. We're going to do taxes with our good friend Bill Nemeth. We're going to talk about things you need to do for the end of the year. All kinds of stuff going on. We're going to catch up with all the business news. You know, the last few years, it hasn't been exactly quiet as we've gotten to the end of the year. So we're definitely going to take a look at all of those news stories and wind our way down with 2011 and get ready to kick off 2012. So I hope you'll join me for that. Starting the 28th for the Clark Howard Show. We have Jason Lovelace from CareerBuilder.com on the phone with us right now. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You know, I wanted to, we've been doing all kinds of information about how to find a great job in 2012, and we saw some really good numbers this week. The first-time unemployment claims have fallen to the lowest level in 3 years. That was great news. Mm-hmm. They're down to about 366,000, about, oh, maybe 100,000 more than they should be. Still, I'll take it. The unemployment rate has dropped. The labor participation rate's a little low. We'd like to see that go up. But overall, it seems like maybe we're just deluding ourselves, or maybe things are getting a little better. But I would like to believe that 2012 is going to be a time where people can actually find a job. First, what are you seeing out there? Are you guys seeing signs that conditions are improving or more jobs being posted?
Well, yes, I would say, of course, CareerBuilder.com is a unbelievable pulse on the marketplace with access to, you know, about 25 to 35% of the employers out there. At any given time, we see the market increasing in multiple areas, not only from a geographic standpoint, but also from a discipline standpoint from particular positions. But overall, the site postings are up anywhere from 20 to 25% across the board. So that means companies actually hiring and posting new positions on the site. And like I said, that's a great indicator on what's to come, and I think the confidence back in the U.S. employment market.
Now, one of the things that's sort of new and a hot topic right now is the idea that employers are actually using, I mean, there's still five people applying for every job that's out there right now, mm-hmm. and employers are actually using credit histories to help discern two seemingly equal clients, applicants for a job. What is that? I know that there are some states that are making that illegal, that practice. What are you guys seeing with regard to this issue? Because it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think it is an interesting issue. I mean, first of all, you know, when you look at what I did is just took some survey information and I looked at a recent survey from the Society of Human Resources Managers. And the reality is that only about 13% of employers are using credit checks on all of their applicants, and about 47% of them are using credit checks, for certain applicants. And I think when they say certain applicants, things that companies are probably using the credit checks on are positions that maybe involve finance or handling money, positions that require access to sensitive information, and then in most cases, a lot of the executive positions, too. So the number isn't as high, and I think there probably is a fear by a lot of applicants out there today because, unfortunately, we've all been the victim of this economic downturn, and a lot of people have been, you know, like I said, victims of this and have faced unfortunate times, and so they're fearful that their credit rating might be exposed to a potential employer. And I would say that is a legitimate legitimate fear, but unfortunately, or fortunately for them, it's not as popular as they would think.
All right, so it's good that it's not that popular. They've always pulled it for jobs involving financial, you know, CFO positions, or if you're going to handle money, you're an accountant, you're in an accounting department, you know, places where you're actually handling the finances of a company. There, I think it must be very high, the number of people that pull it.
Certainly, and probably mandatory in most positions,
right.
I would think.
And we know from people who call the show that there are people who are very concerned about missing a payment on their mortgage simply because their credit could be pulled at any time and their jobs depend on having a good credit score.
Correct. But I think for people that are looking for new positions, you know, one thing to think about is it really comes down to their skills and their experience. Do they fit the criteria that the company has posted for an open position? Do they have the experience and the skill set required for that job? That is probably what the employer is going to look at first. Now, to the point that you made, of course, if it's a financial position or something with sensitive information, they're going to do a credit check. And in many cases, they're going to do credit checks for a variety of positions. But most employers are going to look first for the skill set, and based off their criteria, are going to measure the experience level of that individual for the position.
Well, so here's my question. If only 13% of employers overall are pulling this, why did this, and I think it was in the state of California, didn't they ban pulling credit checks? I mean, there are a lot of states around the country that are getting stirred up about this and trying to ban the practice, right?
Yeah, you know, I couldn't comment on what the state of California is doing specifically, but, you know, there are a lot of people that are out of work, a lot of people that have had unfortunate situations, and some of those same people that have the skills and experience necessary for positions. And I just think that, you know, some of the government bodies are trying to step in and say, hey, there's a lot of good people out there, and as this economic situation turns and companies are beginning to hire, we shouldn't exclude folks.
We shouldn't, but what's sort of interesting is it's not like it's they're going to hire this person or not hire anybody. It's like there are a lot of people looking for a job with good or not so good credit. It's just sort of interesting that they focused on it, if not that many employers are doing it. Now, what is it that they are actually seeing on, or what are they looking for on the credit check? Are they just looking, they're not pulling the score. I know they can't pull a credit score. What are they looking for? Are they looking for big balances? Are they looking for missed payments? What is it they're looking for?
Well, I think they're pulling the traditional credit checks, you know, via either Equifax, TransUnion, or Experian. But there are certain things that they can't pull. And, you know, there's the what's called the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And what this basically states is that they cannot look at things that, for instance, are bankruptcies after 10 years, or civil suits, civil judgments that are 7 years or older,
right.
Paid tax liens that are 7 years or older. So there's a certain criteria in place that they can't look at based off of a time frame. However, that isn't the case for people that are looking for jobs at the $75,000 annual pay or more.
Right.
So it doesn't apply to that. But there are certain things that they can't pull, and they're going to look at a variety of things. Anything that a credit report is going to give them is what they're going to look at.
Let's talk about the local marketplace in Atlanta, because, you know, we have a very high unemployment rate in the state. You know, I know we asked you to do a little research. What did you find out? Where are the jobs in Atlanta and in Georgia in general? What kinds of industries are hiring? And how might our listeners target those fields?
Well, and you know, the funny thing about it is, like I said at the start of this, the encouraging news is that it's up overall. In Atlanta, as you're well aware, you know, the unemployment rate is just below 10%.
Yep.
But when you look overall, year to date on CareerBuilder, the overall job postings are up 27 to almost 30% in some cases. And there's a variety of different capacities that flows through. So you can look at everything from the skilled positions to the non-exempt positions like, you know, for instance, engineering. Jobs are up 47%. Healthcare jobs, we saw a 25% jump. And, you know, there's a variety of companies that are hiring. So when you see these percentages up, and keep in mind, when I'm talking numbers up 25%, 30%, those are on large numbers of jobs that are posted on the Internet. And so, you know, like I said, I'd love to call it an indicator because it really is. And in Atlanta specifically, there are a variety of opportunities. I think the key to any applicant is how are you going to differentiate yourself and showcase the skills and the knowledge that you have to position yourself for that job.
Well, so give us a little bit of, you know, tell us a little bit about how somebody should try and do that, because I know that there's a lot of concern that when you apply online, you could be one of 10,000 people applying for a job. No employer is going to go through all of those. Do they use some sort of technology to whittle it down, looking for certain types of words on the actual resume. How do they do that?
Yeah, today, again, I'll say fortunately or unfortunately, but from an efficiency standpoint, there is technology in place that allows companies to screen through the applicants so that they're saving time and identifying the candidates that do fit the criteria that they're looking for. And my advice to most applicants is, and I'll use this word again, it's all about how do you differentiate yourself with the sheer volume of candidates that are coming through. The first thing you have to remember is, do you have the skills and do you have the experience that's listed in the opportunity? And if you don't, in most cases you're not going to be looked at because they have a specific agenda, specific criteria that they're looking at, and they want to make sure that you have that skill set. But you should also highlight the things that you've accomplished. Make sure that you're using the words that they use within their advertisement so that those words come up when they conduct a search. Talk about your leadership track record. If you've had leadership experience, showcase that. If you've had successes on your position, make sure to identify the things that you've done and how you've helped businesses grow. They're going to want to see things on candidates that have gone above and beyond the norm because, to the point we've been talking about all along, there are a lot of candidates that exist today, but how do you separate yourself from the pack and look as a candidate that they really need working for their organization?
Sort of interesting. So I just went to CareerBuilder.com, and I typed in Georgia, and it said 9,523 jobs found. And in Atlanta, it's 3,533, 3,533 jobs. So it seems like there's a lot of jobs there, although there are a lot more than 9,500 people unemployed in the state of Georgia, for sure. So is that a lot? Is that a big number or a small number? How does that compare?
Well, compared to numbers, let's say, 6-8 years ago, it's not as large, but it still is a significant number. It's up from where it was 2-3 years ago, and it continues to grow, which is great. And, you know, so like I said, overall, when you look at the Career Builder site, there's anywhere, at any given time, anywhere from 6,000 to 750,000 jobs on the website. Today, when you look at the Atlanta market for the search that you conducted, and of course, I can't see what you did, but based on what you told me,
I just put down a link on the homepage. It was not a really deep search, frankly.
See how easy that was for you? But the funny thing is that I'm sure that those positions range everything from retail positions to sales positions to engineering, accounting, you name it.
Yeah, I can see that they're all over the place. Just quickly before we go to break, is there any way that how do you organize them in terms of listing? Is it the most current jobs go on top? Is it the highest paid? Like, why is web developer with HTML5 and CSS3 needed ASAP? Why is that number one versus, like, the food and beverage one?
Well, like any search on the Internet, it's typically done by relevance. So the more information that you provide the site, the better return you're going to get. And in this case, it probably took the positions based just off of listing time because you were very vague about what you put in. But if you went in and said, I'm looking for a sales opportunity in Norcross, Georgia, and were that specific, it would list the positions that met the criteria in the search that you put in. So it's all based off relevance, which makes it easier for not only the applicant but also for the employer.
Perfect. I'm on with Jason Lovelace of CareerBuilder.com. We're going to take a quick break, come back, and get a couple of quick tips that will help set your job search right on the edge for 2012. I'm Elise Glenk. You're listening to News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on. Weekdays with Clark Howard and Dave Ramsey. And midday every Sunday with Elise Glenk on AM 750. And now, 95.5 FM. News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glenk Show. 404-872-0750. I give that number out, but we aren't really having any time. Such really great conversation today, and I hope that you're getting a lot out of it. Online all the time. Think Glink.com, thinkglink.com, and we're going to be able to post the show, I imagine, right after Christmas. Depends on the holiday schedule over WSB, but we'll see. Meanwhile, we're on with Jason Lovelace from CareerBuilder.com, getting a great vision of really how you can start to set up your job search for 2012. Jason, you know, just before break and when we were in the commercial break, you started rattling off a couple of different industries where there simply are not enough people to fill all of the available positions. It seems like those would be the places people would want to go and get some education if they could, or if they wanted employment for life, maybe this is what to do. So start there. What are you guys seeing in terms of trends?
Well, you know, the first thing, you hit on a point there, and then I'll get to that. That is critical for applicants to think about, is how can I transfer my skills or re-educate myself to position myself for these opportunities that I'm about to share, because it comes down to it. There is a shortage in many areas, and so some of the areas that we look at is, let's just take IT, for instance, and let's look at a cloud developer, which is a high-radar position today. And in the cloud developing field, there's only 0.32 active job seekers for every job opening that exists.
Wow, that's really out of balance.
Oh, it really is. And then you take it, let's look at engineering.
So what does that pay, those jobs?
It all depends on the position. It all depends on the company. But it's a very, it's an IT position, so it's going to be a respectable pay. I don't have the range off the top of my head. But
it's, you're looking at something over $60,000 a year.
Certainly.
Which is great.
And then even furthermore, let's take engineering. Let's look at an environmental engineer. There's 1.14 active job seekers for every open position that exists. So just over one per position, which means that companies are going to be looking for those individuals and trying to find them.
Now, we all know that healthcare is another area where, people are just getting older. So they're getting older, they're getting fatter, they're getting sicker. This is what we've been hearing on, in the presidential debates. And it's costing us a lot of money. But this is an opportunity if you're looking for a job. Nursing school, there's never enough nurses out there.
Well, the irony is my wife is actually going back to get her master's in nursing after not working for 14 years raising our kids. So that, I'm proof of that right there. But yes, the healthcare industry, and I hate to say recession-proof, but it almost is.
We've seen
the healthcare industry continue to transition and grow in positions created on an ongoing basis. One in particular that I'm looking at here is, for a nurse practitioner, there's only 0.27 active job seekers for every open position.
A nurse practitioner
is a skilled position, as you're probably well aware.
And you're going to hear about nurse practitioners more and more. That is just from somebody who's working in the whole Medicare industry right now. For sure it's happening. Jason Lovelace is with CareerBuilder.com. You can go online to CareerBuilder and search for the job of your dreams. Folks, we are running out of time. I'm going to be back after Christmas. I wish all of my listeners a Merry Christmas and a Happy Hanukkah. Marvelous New Year. I'll be filling in for Clark starting on the 28th. Join me at 1. Set your calendar and your clock and have a great week and a Merry Christmas.